It's Wednesday, March 17th, 2021, and this is another socially distant edition of KBIA's Views of the News. I'm Amy Simons, coming to you from the studio in the Reynolds Journalism Institute. My colleagues, Ernest Perry and Kathy Kiley, are with me, as always, for our weekly conversation on media behaviors. Hi, Ernest.
Hi, Amy.
Kathy, hi. Good to see you today.
Top of the day to you, Professors O. Simons and O. Perry.
Okay, well, on our...
Everybody's Irish on St. Paddy's Day.
On our program this week.
This week, as he now seems to every week, Tucker set off a bit of a firestorm.
Media critics have their eyes set on Tucker Carlson. We're going to talk about why. The sale of the Baltimore Sun might be off. We're going to talk about why that's exciting staffers at the Sun's sister papers within Tribune Publishing. And missing the inside of the newsroom, the set, and doing journalism as we knew it just 53 weeks ago. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our half hour is up today. But I want to start by asking Ernest and Kathy about what's going on here in mid-Missouri and across the country when it comes to the rollout of the coronavirus vaccine. A week ago, we were getting emails from public information officers seeking the media's help in getting qualifying mid-Missourians into vaccination clinics to keep the state allocated doses from going to waste. Well, this past Monday, the next tier opened up and we're back to where we were 5 or 6 weeks ago, with people clamoring for appointments and trying to get clarity on who is eligible in the current tier and at what cost to get vaccinated for those without insurance. Ernest, the levels of confusion here, they kind of seem to be cyclical with the rollout of each of the additional tiers. Let me start by asking you, how much of that is the result of either bad management at the state or federal level? How much is unclear reporting on the behalf of journalists? Or how much is in an uninformed public?
Well, I think it's maybe a combination of all of that, but I think it really starts at poor management and communication on the part of both federal and state officials, going all the way back to when we knew that the vaccines were coming, there was just no pre-planning of how this was going to roll out by the previous presidential administration. They pretty much handed it over to the states, and a lot of it was, you know, was your state in a position to be able to deal with this? And as we all saw with testing, those states that did sort of adequate testing may have had some way in which to be able to roll that out, and those who didn't just weren't able to do it. And now we're seeing that same thing sort of play out to a certain extent as it relates to the vaccine.
So, Kathy, of those three, Ernest is saying it's a little bit of a combination of all of them. Where might you kind of pinpoint some of that confusion stemming from?
Well, I think this is it's a failure of leadership, really. It's, you know, and it's a sad thing. I mean, I'm a political reporter, and it's really sad for me to see our political leadership preferring to have infighting and one-upmanship rather than pulling together and trying to work in an organized fashion, both to get the vaccines out where they're needed and also to get the messaging out to the media so that we can in turn share that with our readers. I mean, when you're getting mixed messages from the people who should be in a position of authority, it's really hard for the media, I think, to do an adequate job, because it's kind of who's on first. And so this is a case, I think, I know, we in the United States do not like centralized government, and that's a great thing. It's been a great strength of the United States, but this is a case that screams out for a centralized, all hands on deck, everybody rowing in the same direction, and we just haven't seen it.
And Ernest, this wasn't something we talked about last week, and it was something you said to me, hey, why aren't we talking about it? I said, you know, I think we've got a great spot for it next week when that tier three opens back up. But we talk about that need for the centralized government response here. We talk about the confusion that comes from the state and the federal government sending mixed messages. And last week we were in one of those periods where the federal government and President Biden is saying we're going to open up to all K-12 teachers nationwide the availability of vaccines. Yet, at least in our state, that availability wasn't opened up earlier. Personally, I can't quite understand why not at that point. But that also created additional confusion for the general public because there were some clinics that were vaccinating K-12 teachers while others refused.
Yeah, it was sort of this thing where if you received vaccinations from the federal pool, then teachers were eligible to be able to receive the vaccine. And that mainly went out, at least in the state of Missouri, that mainly went out to Walmart, CVS, Walgreens, places like that. However, if you were receiving vaccinations from the state, then you had to sort of adhere to whatever tier that was in place at that particular time. That led to the confusion. And so it was difficult for the media to relay that message out because they're trying to, you know, sort of do this within real time and actually help people be able to find vaccinations. And then the story all of a sudden became a sort of free-for-all where you had people driving 2 to 3 hours across the state of Missouri to find a vaccine at a particular location because, you know, they happen to have it, whereas the place right down the street from your house didn't have it or was under some sort of state guideline.
Or wouldn't give it to you.
Or wouldn't give it to
you. Yeah, I saw a great, great tweet over the last week or in the past couple of days from Tony Messinger, the great Pulitzer Prize winning columnist for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. And he drove all the way to Sedalia, which is probably 2.5 hours from where he lives, and to get his shot because he couldn't get one in St. Louis. And he said that with the exception of one person in that line, almost everyone was from St. Louis. Yeah. So he wasn't alone. And that, you know, that's just an example of kind of the patchwork hodgepodge this has been. The idea of giving 50 states, which really was the previous administration's decision, letting all 50 states set their own parameters for who was going to get what when. It was just a recipe for chaos and confusion, and that's what we're seeing.
Another one of the issues that we're seeing too is, and this is something that I have kind of grappled with myself through this process, is that so much of the vaccine distribution network and the communication therein is tied specifically to technology that is it has set up a system of privilege. If you have access to mobile devices, if you have access to texting, to social media, to internet where you are constantly connected, you can get information about where and when vaccine appointments are available. But if you don't have those devices, or if you don't have internet at home, and perhaps only do if you're working, or if you are without internet while you are at work in a service-related job for hours at a time, the availability of those appointments, you have no way to know when it is your turn in line and to take advantage of it. And there have been a lot of stories. There was one that I was asked to speak on KMIZ last week. You can see it on our links blog about how people have really developed communities on social media to help connect their neighbors who may not otherwise be connected to get that access. And I guess it is one of the first really good uses of social media that we've seen in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been very important. I mean, it's opened up that opportunity, but again, it does, which the pandemic has really exposed a lot of areas in which there's inequality, and I think this is one of them. If you're in a poor neighborhood, or you're in an urban area, or you're in a rural area where there's not enough broadband, you don't have that kind of access. If you're of an older generation who doesn't really understand how those social media outlets work or how to actually use the internet, you're at a disadvantage in this. And so I think that was not taken into account, as Kathy's talked about. I think that was also a part of mismanagement and lack of leadership on the part of state and federal officials, and how do you deal with that? But it has also opened up opportunities for people to sort of step in and help those in need be able to access that. But if we're gonna meet the mandates that President Biden has set out, there's going to have to be more of a coordinated effort on the part of federal and state officials to be able to reach that sort of herd immunity that they're talking about, mm-hmm. and to do it by the middle of the summer.
So, Kathy, I'm hoping you can tell us a little bit about what's been going on in San Francisco, where a resident of a halfway house has been punished for speaking out about the spread of the virus in that facility. What's been going on there?
Yeah, this is a really disturbing story. This is a guy named Malik Washington, who was incarcerated and certainly has paid his debt to society. I think he had a 13-year sentence. I may be wrong about how much of that he's fulfilled, but he's been in prison for quite some time. And now he is in a halfway house. And this is, looks on the surface to be a model prisoner. This is somebody who acquired a skill while he was in prison. He started writing for a newspaper. He has been named the editor of that newspaper. So not only does he have a job waiting for him, he already has a job. And so he's a journalist, and he's very close to being released and being a free man. But the halfway house he's living in had an outbreak. He spoke to a journalist colleague about that, and suddenly his release date has been pushed back, and he's filed a lawsuit. And in the middle of all this, I think very interestingly, the halfway house where he's living is one of those homes that is run by a private prison company. Mm-hmm. A lot has been written about these private prison companies. And the question is, were they doing their job in keeping the people in their care safe from this illness? But these companies are notorious for being major campaign givers to both parties. So I think this case bears watching. It's certainly on the surface. It looks like a free speech case. He's filed a lawsuit, and he's got a lot of support from other journalists in the Bay Area where he lives. So I'll certainly be watching it as a free speech advocate.
So here's a question, though, especially as we talk about free speech. And we have talked a bunch in the past about the newsroom that operates in San Quentin and the work that comes out of there. I personally am a huge fan of the journalism there. They have their own chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists, Ear Hustle, which was it's a award-winning podcast, which was born in San Quentin. But that's a state prison. And I have to ask, do federal prisoners have different rights to free speech within the prison system? Because technically he is still considered part of, he is still within that system. So does the Bureau of Prisons have the right to limit his speech in this type of a situation?
I don't think they should. I mean, he's almost a whistleblower. I mean, he is a whistleblower in this case. So, I think we certainly, if there's a COVID outbreak in a congregate living facility, I think the public needs to know about that. It's not just the prisoners themselves who are affected, but everyone else who goes in and out of that facility is a potential vector for infection. So, punishing somebody for telling the truth, I don't think ever should be permissible in a free society.
As we look for what would be going forward, is this the type of a thing that you could see? We've talked about, Maria Ressa. We've talked about other journalists in other countries that we've seen journalists kind of back and do a lot of advocacy work for and on their behalf. Why do you think Malik Washington's story is one that's not coming front and center?
You know, I think that's a really interesting question, and I don't know the answer to it. I checked with the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. The person I checked with wasn't familiar with the case. I'm a little surprised about that. I'll be interested to see if there is more attention paid to this going forward. I think it's certainly, as I say, on the surface, it seems like a very deserving case. Mm-hmm. And certainly this is somebody who, this is what we want. We want prisoners to be rehabilitated, and he's doing good journalism. So you go.
Okay. Pick up or tune into any sort of left-leaning news outlet in the past few days, and chances are you're going to have seen or read something very critical of Fox News darling Tucker Carlson, CNN, The Washington Post, even HBO. Here's John Oliver from Sunday's episode of Last Week Tonight.
Of all the things that Tucker is, a conspiracy theorist, a misogynist, Islamophobe, a troll, one of the most dangerous is that he is the most prominent vessel in America for white supremacist talking points. And I already know what Tucker will say about this, because whenever this topic comes up, he has the exact same reaction. What does that even mean?
White nationalism. Let's be literal for a minute. What is that exactly?
I don't even know what white nationalism means, and I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole with you now.
Why doesn't anyone ever define white supremacy? What is white supremacy?
Can somebody tell us in very clear language what a white supremacist is?
Okay. First, very clear language seems like a high bar to clear for a man who spends 85% of his time making the befuddled face of a 13th century farmer learning about Bitcoin. And I promise that we're actually going to give Tucker a pretty clear definition of white supremacy later in this piece. And he does seem to need one, because whenever he tries to define it himself, it tends to be self-servingly narrow.
This show was not on the air for 6 months before there was an organized and highly aggressive campaign by prominent Democrats to denounce us as white supremacists. The first time it happened, the people who work on this show, many of them kids, were shocked and horrified by that. White supremacists? What's worse than that? The phrase evokes images of burning crosses and lynchings. It's awful.
Okay, first, I'm so sorry, Tucker. I honestly didn't realize that your show was staffed entirely by children. I certainly never intended for them to get caught up in all of this, so my sincere apologies, you tiny little rascals. But I don't burn crosses or lynch people, so I can't be a white supremacist, is a pretty weak argument. It's like saying I can't be an anti-Semite because I didn't do the Holocaust, or I can't be a sexual predator because I didn't produce Good Will Hunting. There is more than one way to be a terrible person.
So Oliver went on pretty dramatically for another 15 minutes or so, using his own brand of humor to detail all of the different ways that Carlson, as he puts it, asks the tough questions to spread white nationalist talking points on his show on Fox almost every night. And Ernest, to me, this segment seemed like it was really most effective in the way that it decoded a lot of Carlson's superficially innocent statements and questions by using his own words against him.
No, absolutely. I mean, this was sort of a rhetorical takedown of Tucker Carlson, using his own words, using his own phrases, and literally answering the questions that Tucker Carlson sort of poses on his show on a nightly basis to basically say, look, you know, if you're asking the question, what is a white nationalist or what is a white supremacist? Here are the answers to your question, and I'm going to use your own words to answer those questions. So it was really a good piece, but it does speak to the fact that, to me, Tucker Carlson has basically picked up the ball that was left by the previous administration and is carrying it forward on his talk show. It's right out of what happened on January 6th and a lot of things that was happening even before then.
So it's interesting you should say that, because Brian Stelter on his program Reliable Sources on Sunday actually came out in his criticism of Tucker Carlson and said flat out, Tucker Carlson is the next Donald Trump, that in the next 4 years, he is, as you just said, Ernest, picking up the ball, he's running with it, and he still has that daily platform to be able to continue to have those communications with the audience and to continue to keep its attention in that way. And Kathy, I hate when it feels like history is repeating itself, but 5 and 6 years ago, we were asking some of these same questions. Do we, as the news media, feed into the beast? Do we give him the attention he's looking for? Or do we call it out for what it is and hope that we can somehow reach that audience that We've actually proven to ourselves over the course of the last few years, we haven't been able to reach.
Well, you know, I've known Tucker Carlson since he was a wet behind the ears intern at the Arkansas Democrat Gazette editorial page when I worked there. And so, you know, I think Tucker has always wanted to be what he is now, which is a media figure. And I was amused this week. I happened to catch part of Joe Biden's speech that he gave on the anniversary of the COVID pandemic on Fox News. Mm-hmm. And what was amusing
where they had the Tucker cam in the corner with his facial expressions.
Postage stamp of Tucker in the bottom of the screen, and it was Tucker React. So they wanted the audience to see Tucker's facial reactions to the president's speech. And then afterwards, when Tucker Carlson's show came on, it was Tucker reacts to the Biden speech, which I thought was hilarious, you know, like, who cares? And so clearly Fox is trying to build Tucker Carlson up as their next Sean Hannity. I think it's more likely he's a Sean Hannity than the next Donald Trump. But
What would make you say that? Because I look back to where we were looking at Donald Trump 6 years ago and going, really, that guy from The Apprentice? He's going to go ahead and become the next president of the United States? So what makes you see that more as a Hannity thing and maybe not kind of taking that Trump path?
I mean, Donald Trump had some political connections,
yeah,
and he had money.
Okay.
Tucker doesn't have the money.
Well, except for that whole Swanson fortune to which he is connected.
Well, that's true. But yeah. I think it almost doesn't matter. The point is that Fox is clearly trying to build Tucker up. Tucker has made himself kind of the spokesperson for aggrieved white people, which is kind of amusing given that he is himself a product of the Washington elite. His father worked in the Nixon administration. His father was an ambassador. Tucker went to boarding schools. You know, it's a classic Washington elite upbringing. So, but I think because it's clear from all the things we've been talking about that Fox is elevating Tucker as the spokesperson for aggrieved white people, the media is reacting. I would say, to answer your question, point it out, but then let it go, because the more who cares about Tucker Carlson? He's a media guy. He has absolutely no one's ever elected him to anything. No one's so you can create him into something much bigger than he is, or you can just point out what's going on and move on to some real problem, like how do people get COVID vaccines?
Okay. We've had to drop quite a few topics from our shows the past few weeks, and there has been so much to talk about, that's why. One of those topics we've tried to get into our mix and haven't been able to has been about Alden Global Capital's purchase of most of Tribune Publishing. In that deal, Alden would be taking over all but one of the Tribune newspapers, the Baltimore Sun. The Sun would go to local philanthropist Stuart Bainum Jr. It was a huge blow that word of that sale was going to be happening to the journalists at the Tribune papers that were not the Sun, knowing they were going to be going into the hands of a hedge fund known for decimating all of those they've bought before. But according to a report in the Sunday New York Times, that big chunk of the Trib deal could be falling apart, and Bainum could be making a play for the whole company. Kathy, he was going to buy the Sun for $65 million. He'd need 10 times that to be able to buy all of Tribune Publishing. That's a lot of money. How's he going to go about trying to structure this deal?
Well, according to the reports, and this makes sense, he wants to, once he makes the purchase, spin off the Tribune properties to local owners. So I would think what he might be trying to do is create a syndicate, similar to the kind of syndicates that own baseball teams and football teams now, and with probably the understanding that some of those people would become the local owners of their individual papers. Boy, am I rooting for this. I think it would be an incredibly healthy thing. I think we've seen not just in the newspaper industry, but when we try to go for economies of scale and we try to turn news organizations into national publications, it really doesn't work out. I think it'd be better for communities to have community-owned newspapers, so I hope we can pull it off. And I'm sure every Tribune employee is saying the same little prayer before they go to bed at night.
Okay. One last thing before we go today. Of all of the stories that I've seen, read, or watched in the past week of living through our first year of the pandemic, the one that hit home the hardest was Sarah Lyle's piece about how much she misses being inside the newsroom and what it's like to see it empty. We've been somewhat lucky here, Ernest, getting to come back to the university setting to be able to work with our students and our newsrooms, agencies, and classrooms in hybrid settings. Sometimes there are face-to-face barriers between us. Sometimes it's over Zoom. But to read some of these pieces, we can only begin to yearn for what's ahead.
I think this is not just in the media business, but also in all businesses. I think that there is a certain, and I think even larger segment than we knew of people who want to go back into the settings in which they work. They want to be able to physically separate where they work as opposed to where they live. And so I think journalists are no different in that regard. And even though many journalists, believe it or not, they were working outside of the office even before COVID, and many newsrooms were a lot smaller in terms of space at the beginning than they had previously been. I think this is going to exacerbate that problem. I think many of them are not going to come back, but I do think that there will probably be more of them coming back in the same way with all businesses.
The Washington Post, go ahead.
I started in the newspaper business because I loved a newsroom. The people there are funny, they're irreverent, and people in newsrooms miss being around each other. There was, early in the pandemic, the Reynolds Journalism Institute had a roundtable with photographers about how they were staying safe in the pandemic. And one of the photographers from the San Francisco Chronicle, I believe, said, you know, I can't wait for the next election night pizza party. And I think we all feel that way. Newsrooms are special places.
Yeah,
I can't wait to get back.
So, Ernest, one of the things you were saying, though, about how there might be some people who are somewhat reluctant to come back. We've even seen that here with some of our colleagues. Right. The Washington Post is going to be opening it back up. At least the plan right now would be July 6th, starting with volunteers, asking people. There's at least one union that's trying to negotiate protections from employees. As we talk about labor and management, who or where do you see there kind of being that leverage right now? And maybe do the employees kind of have a little bit more of that? And is there more of that work-life balance, and how do we keep our people safe maybe than we had a year and a half ago?
I think a lot of it is going to depend on what is the situation on the ground in that particular city. If the vaccine is there, if the numbers are good, then I think it's going to be on the part of the company in terms of leverage. If it's the other way around, then I think the employees are going to have the leverage. But there will be some give and take in there, and there's going to have to be a lot of conversation about what that looks like going forward.
Okay. Well, we are out of time for today. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. Read more about each of our topics on our Links blog under both the programs and podcast tabs at kbia.org. We're also available wherever you get your podcast downloads, including iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @views on KBIA. You can watch and listen to our program again, leave comments, questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing the show, Aaron Hay for handling the audio, and Tim Pilcher for composing our theme music. I'm Amy Simons. We'll see you again next week when we're back with another edition of Views of the News.